Welcome to Lady Killers with me, Lucy Worsley, from BBC Radio 4. In this episode, we're investigating true crime itself, and we're asking, why has it become such an obsession of ours? And was it ever thus? I should warn you that this episode contains material some listeners may find distressing. In this season so far, we've experienced some things that'll be very familiar to anyone who regularly consumes true crime documentaries, podcasts, and books. We've had dramatic phone calls from the scene of the crime.
Come at once! Come at once! There's been a terrible accident!
Eyewitnesses recounting suspicious behaviour.
I saw her wheeling a bassinet perambulator in the middle of the road.
Expert witnesses analysing the crime scene.
The absence of blood everywhere but in this room seems to show that he must have been killed in this room.
The accused trying to mount a defence.
I was much whipped by my master to extort a confession.
What makes this different? Well, all these cases happened between 90 and 150 years ago. And all these perpetrators were women. This is Lady Killers. Join me and my crack team of all-female detectives as we take a look, a feminist look actually, at the crimes and times of women who killed. Today, we will be putting the genre of true crime itself on trial. And we'll be asking, is it guilty of perpetuating stereotypes about gender and violence? Or are we to blame for not looking beyond the headlines? Why are we drawn to the darkness? Is our culture guilty of an exceptional fascination with violent crime, cold cases, detection and murder? Or has this always been the case? To help me set the stage for the trial, I'm joined by the ever-brilliant Professor Rosalind Crone, our in-house historian and wise voice of reason. Welcome, Roz.
Hello, Lucy.
And the true crime enthusiast and podcaster, co-host of the hit series Red Handed, it's Hannah Maguire.
Thank you for having me. This is really exciting.
Hannah, when you started your podcast Red Handed with Saruti Bala back in 2017, why did you choose to tell true crime stories? What is it about that kind of story that appeals?
I think it appeals to everyone. And I think the people who say it doesn't are liars. Nobody goes around murdering people for no reason. And so I've always found the run-up of what has to happen to a person for them to be capable of something I can't even wrap my head around. That's the interesting bit for me.
Yeah, yeah. I know that you studied social anthropology, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Does that mean that you're the sort of person who's always had a craving to understand human behaviour?
I wish that was true. Unfortunately, I chose my degree because I thought it would make me sound interesting. And it worked. But I, by accident, ended up studying why people do things, which is really interesting. So I got lucky.
Do your qualifications help you to see the insights and motivations of people around you, though?
I think so. And I think I'm the only person from my year group that actually uses the degree that we studied in their job. Nobody goes on to be an anthropologist, really. But I do use it all the time. And I think it gives you the ability to see things from up here.
Yes, yes. Listeners, she just put her hand in the air.
Sorry. <yeah.
laughs> My goodness, I thought this woman was a podcaster.
Well, yeah, but I'm just a, like, under the stairs gremlin. Like, I don't know how to do this.
You're more than that. Anyway, you've made your tutors proud, I'm sure, at the social anthropology department.
Yeah, I think I have.
Now, Roz, as a 19th century social historian, you spend a lot of your time thinking about crime and justice. I know that. Would you also say that you're a fan of the true crime genre?
I do like to study true crime. I think it can reveal really interesting things about human nature and especially the human experience, especially in the past.
So you are a fan of true crime, but it's got to be Victorian.
Well, you could put it that way, yes.
Shall we start by defining what true crime might actually mean? I think it's a genre of nonfiction that explores real-life criminal events, focusing on the details of the crime, the actions of the people involved, and the motivations of the perpetrators. I think it delves into the circumstances surrounding the crime and the impact it has on victims and their communities. And true crime is everywhere. It's on the radio, it's on the telly, it's in your podcast feed, and it's thriving right here at Lady Killers. Hannah, why do you think that true crime is so big in our culture? Why did it spring up in the first place in the audio world?
When we first started Red Handed, and all of the sort of OG true crime podcasts are all homegrown grassroots shows because media houses weren't making the shows and people wanted them. My Favourite Murder, Last Podcast on the Left, are all conversational shows that are really successful and have been going for nearly a decade now. But because it wasn't being made by legacy media back then, it didn't come with the stamp of approval. So people were quite critical of it, still are in some places.
That's interesting that you see it as a sort of outsider art form. Well, what do you think? Why is true crime so big in our culture?
There's something about true crime that provides a vehicle for expressing anxieties about society. At the same time, it's titillation, isn't it? Sensationalism. People love stories about human tragedy. And that's been the case for hundreds of years.
I think part of the attraction for me as well is the idea of playing sleuth, helping to solve the crime. I feel like I can do it, even though the police have failed. What's the history of the armchair detective?
If we go back to the 18th century, victims were much more involved in the detection and the prosecution of crime. It was really their responsibility in a society that was lightly policed. That begins to change in the 19th century, and the police start taking on detection and also as prosecutors. And I think people felt that they need a different way to be involved, and hence the rise of the armchair detective.
So if you'd lived in the 18th century, you might have solved crime for real if you were a victim of it, because there was no policeman to do it for you. But by the 19th century, there was. So you were kind of treated as a hobby, a leisure activity.
Yeah, that's right.
Hannah, I think it's correct that the majority of listeners to Red Handed are female. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that women in particular are interested in true crime?
I think humans just are morbidly fascinated by things. True crime as a space is very safe for women to be in. Men are allowed to be completely obsessed with war and no one thinks that's weird. But true crime is a space for women to be able to exercise this morbid fascination without being told they're doing it wrong.
Oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. But have you heard the argument that maybe women worry more about becoming a victim of crime and therefore kind of want to prepare themselves in some sense?
Yes, I used to ascribe to it myself, like protecting yourself with information. I'm not sure I believe that anymore because I don't want to make any woman feel like any sort of perpetual victim. But I think it's more to do with the morbid fascination side of it.
Ross, can you tell us a bit more about the genre of true crime? In the 19th century, what forms did it take?
The taste for true crime really became something for the working classes from the turn of the 19th century. And this is because the middle classes, who had been the main consumers of the biographies of criminals in the 18th century, no longer saw this as a respectable thing to consume. At the same time, the execution broadsides and also biographies of criminals began to be printed in really cheap forms for ordinary people who were also starting to become more literate. They fed into the rise of the newspaper. And the newspapers then fed back to middle-class audiences a more respectable way to consume true crime. At the same time, public executions were still a thing until 1868. And then, of course, we have a whole kind of material culture that grows up around the scaffold, famous murderers, etc. So we have the street entertainments, the peep shows that people pay a penny to look at on the streets, to big panoramas that are staged where you go inside a theatre and you end up in the middle of a crime scene. You also have waxworks, most famous being Madame Tussauds, of course, and her Chamber of Horrors, and then even the Staffordshire figurines. And they were small kind of pieces of pottery, which were representations of the famous criminals, especially murderers, and even the sites of their crimes.
Have you got one of these, Hannah?
I was going to ask for one. Do you have one?
No, I don't. But you're the perfect owner of a Staffordshire figurine of a murderer. I'm amazed you haven't got one already. Hannah, do you think that the people in the past are like us, different from us in being fascinated by crime?
I think it's exactly the same. And I think we're seeing a very similar thing happen with the spread of true crime content because everybody can make it now, just like journalism was more widespread because of printing technology improvement. It's exactly the same thing.
To To understand more about how people in the past consumed crime as entertainment, we're going to take a look at three of our cases from this series and examine people's reactions to them at the time. First up, we're going back to Dorset in 1856 and the case of Martha Brown, a woman hanged for killing her husband. The case shocks the nation and even inspires Thomas Hardy's Tessa the D'Urbervilles. And the twist of this case is that 2 days before her execution, Martha confesses that she acted because of years of abuse by her victim, her husband. Her life might have been spared.
I had never struck him before after all his ill treatment, but he hit me so hard.
But the Home Secretary, the only one with the power to grant a reprieve, is out of the office. No one else can step in, so the execution goes ahead. Whilst Martha Brown garners enormous public sympathy, even before she makes her confession, do you think that that's influenced by how the media at the time were covering her?
Yeah, I think in this case, it's quite useful to think about Robert Darnton's communication circuit, the idea that media reflects public opinion, but also shapes public opinion. And at this time, we have communities writing petitions, begging for mercy for Martha Brown. And this comes from a broader sympathy for female murderers. It's part of what Martin Wiener calls the reconstruction of gender, where women are considered to be passive and weak, and therefore much less of a threat and deserving of sympathy, especially if their husbands have done wrong. And in this case, John Brown had been having an affair with a neighbour and people thought that was rather terrible. It's important to say that other newspapers were full of editorials which very much believed that execution was the right punishment for her.
So Martha's trial sort of continues beyond the courtroom in the public sphere. Hannah, do these Victorian petitions asking for clemency for Martha Brown remind you of the podcast Serial, where a lot of people got involved in the case and started to ask questions and it reignited interest in whether Adnan Syed had done it or not in the US?
Yeah, absolutely. Attention and pressure and letters can make a real difference. And podcast investigations themselves can change the way they go too, like Teacher's Pet's Australian podcast that has led to a conviction without a body because of the investigation through the podcast.
Now, Thomas Hardy's Tessa the D'Urbervilles was inspired by the real life case of Martha Brown because he was present as a boy at her execution where he saw her actual body swinging in the wind. That stayed with him. Hannah, I think we're all familiar with true crime that begins with a woman's body, either dead on the slab or else running naked and terrified through the woods. Do you think that this is still a central image in a lot of true crime, or are times changing?
The unfortunate thing about true crime is that it happened. You can't change the ending or the beginning. There's a really famous case of a serial killer in the US, David Parker Ray, and he would abduct women and drug them so they wouldn't remember and then turn them out on the streets with no memory of where they'd been. And you have to start that story with one of them running completely naked with a dog collar around her neck because that's what happened.
I guess I think I may have noticed, I don't know about you, what I might call progressive true crime that concentrates more on the victims rather than the killer and the lower down in society rather than the higher up, that kind of thing.
I call it clean true crime.
Where
people want to make true crime content because it's popular and it sells and it makes money and people want it, but they don't want to be accused of being grubby or salacious, so they do it victim-centered. It's not really about the killers. I'm doing it for the victims. Are you? I think you just want to make a popular show.
Look at us all squirming in our seats here. She's called us out very effectively.
We don't focus on victims.
No, you guys are fine.
Let's take a look at our next case in London in 1890. It's the end of the 19th century and investigative journalism has taken off. The press simply can't get enough of Mary Pearcey. In this case, we have a blood-stained crime scene, two victims, one a child. It's the stuff of nightmares. And yet the Victorians can't seem to look away.
The walls and ceiling and floor were bespattered with blood.
Mary Pearcey is having an affair with Frank Hogg, and it's jealousy that drives her to murder Frank's wife Phoebe and their baby daughter, little Tiggy.
My heart throbs with pain only thinking about it. What would I do if you went? For that is the only thing I care for on earth.
was. Could you tell us how the press covered Mary Pearcy's case and what the public reaction to it all was like?
Yes, well, they jumped on it straight away. And of course they did, because here we have a dark alley, the discovery of a woman's body in a mutilated condition. They also made a series of assumptions. The woman must be a prostitute, the killer must be a man, and the killer could be Jack the Ripper. And even when they printed the police's objections to these assumptions, they were still repeating them.
When Madame Tussauds opened a display about this case, 31,000 people turned up to see it. Hannah, do you think you would have been among them if you'd been in London in 1890?
Yeah, absolutely. It is just fascinating. And I probably am more vocal about it than other people, but I think everyone wants to have a look.
You're saying aloud the quiet bits, aren't you? That's what your argument is.
Yeah, I can't help myself.
Yeah. Now, with the Mary Pearcy case, people actually pay money to visit the mortuary and view the bodies of the victims. That's so strange and weird. Tell us more about that, Roz.
Yes, they did. And thousands turned up to the funerals of Phoebe and baby Tiggy, with family members giving interviews to the press. This is a case of people wanting to be inside the drama, with this desire to be part of the story as it's unfolding.
Do you think that a lot of this attention focused upon Mary Pearcy because of her gender? She seemed extra abhorrent because of her being female.
I think she's earned such an enduring place in Madame Tussauds' Chamber of Horrors because she's a woman, because these questions about the brutality of the murder and a woman being involved persist.
Hannah, in crime reporting today, do you think that because there are more women involved in the media, things are changing, maybe fewer assumptions about how bad women can get?
When a woman is convicted of a violent crime, she will get a longer sentence than a man, especially a woman killing a baby. That's as bad as it gets. And we're so reviled by it and we can't understand it because it doesn't fit into what we think women are. Mm. And we still do that.
Now, here's a weird thing. People often say to me that they find crime comforting. People talk about binging on true crime, getting their fix of it, even falling asleep listening to it. Does this desensitise us in some way? What do you think, Hannah?
I don't think so. But I have definitely noticed in myself, after doing it red-handed as long as I have, I don't think I know what's shocking anymore. Like, I think I've lost my revile radar. It just doesn't exist anymore. So I have to ask other people if something's bad or not. But in terms of like passive consumption, I don't think it's that bad. I think there are other things to worry about in the world.
We have a young listener, and I've heard that she listens to Lady Killers in bed. I'm like, what? And I've also learned that if it gets too scary, then she switches back to the Wumbles.
That's amazing.
What do you think, Rods? Do you think that talking about true crime as entertainment desensitises?
Possibly to some extent it does, but we should be more concerned about the fact that true crime can give a kind of version of criminal activity which doesn't bear much resemblance to the truth. Our true crime focus usually tends to be on the sensational crimes, but most crime that happens is petty offending. And while it could be a useful vehicle for expressing and containing social fears, we've also got to watch out for true crime becoming a way to perpetuate stereotypes about gender and ethnicity and class. And that's certainly something that we see in the past with true crime.
Some of the people turning up to the crime scene in Mary Pearcy's case were wanting to be citizen detectives. Hannah, what did you make of the case of Nicola Bulley, who in 2023 tragically disappeared while walking her dog by the river near her home in Lancashire?
It was just so, so sad. I always think about how there was a lot of speculation about how her dog wasn't wet. So she couldn't have just fallen in the river because her dog would have gone on after her. But obviously she did and the dog didn't. But that was such a speculation for so long. And there was a lot of speculation about whether she was an alcoholic or not. And I just thought that must have been so awful for her family, because to not know where she is, but then also have people just picking her life apart as well. I think that taking it upon yourself to investigate that, I think doing it in your house like a jigsaw puzzle is fine. I think accusing people in the real world is really, really dangerous.
In our final case, we travel to London in the early 20th century, where tabloid journalism was well established. And true crime's an important part of tabloid journalism, especially when a glamorous 27-year-old socialite is involved. I'm talking, of course, about Elvira Barney, who in 1932 shoots her lover and walks away scot-free, only to die at 32 after yet another night of parties, drink and drugs. This story gives readers a rare glimpse of upper-class life, and it's causing a stir.
Get out of my house at once! I hate you! Get out! I will shoot you! I will shoot you!
I'm going! God! What have you done?
Michael! Come back to me! Michael! Michael!
This was a huge deal when it came to court. Roz, could you describe some of the scenes that happened at the court and some of the reporting?
Yes, I mean, what happened inside the courtroom was incredible. We had working class neighbours of Elvira turning up, and they were completely discredited by the defence barrister. And then, of course, he stood up and gave the most amazing speech that said to the jury, basically, you should find her not guilty because she's this grieving young person. She's grieving over the death of her lover. And it's amazing looking at the press coverage as well, with the lack of critique of Elvira and also almost the sympathy for her too. There's hardly any critique of that judgment that's given. And there's almost like a celebration when she returns home.
Hannah, why do you think cases involving celebrities or members of the elite are so irresistible?
I think it's because we don't like them. So it's okay to be critical and fascinated. And the crime gives us an opportunity to see how these famous people who live these wonderful lives that we're all a bit jealous of, and we all agree as a society that the pursuit of fame is vapid. So therefore, what happens to you doesn't really matter. And it's okay for me to be rooting for you to lose.
Do you think that perhaps as well, when you look at, say, the royal family, for example, we see their births, their deaths, their marriages, and we all see it, and it sort of marks the tempo of our own collective lives?
I think so. I'd never really thought about it in that particular way. Like, my grandma, completely and utterly obsessed with the Queen, so when the Queen died, she rang me in to tell me that she wished it was her. But because they were born in the same year, she definitely throughout her whole life, like, toe-to-toe almost, throughout her chapters of life.
So in a sense, they fulfil a need. Now then, we are very well aware that we're part of all of this. Lady Killers itself is in the genre of true crime. But one of the many reasons we make this series is to show that women aren't just the helpless victims of crime, as they're so often depicted. And we think that looking at crime can be a great way of learning about the past. Roz, what do you think records about crime can tell us about women's lives in the past?
What we're trying to do on Lady Killers and also on Lady Swindlers is to give a real representative account of the different types of killing and swindling that women are involved in. We're really trying to tap into the issues that women faced in the past. And a really good example of that would be going back to an age where you didn't have reliable contraception or any of the modern forms of contraception we know about today. We have what I call the unholy trinity of death. So what do you do if you found out you're pregnant in the 19th century and you can't have the child for various reasons? Well, you could get an abortion that was criminalized, obviously. You could have the baby and kill it at birth, so infanticide, or you could put it out to a baby farmer who would kill it on your behalf. What I hope that we also do is we use that reflection on the past as a way to talk about challenges that women continue to face in the present.
Hannah, what do you think? Do you justify your work as fun and entertainment, or do you think that you're carrying out anthropological investigation into human behaviour?
You can't separate the two things, I don't think. Certainly when you are looking at things from an anthropological perspective, you do find over the collection of data over years and years and years, you do see the same things again and again and again. You can weave that narrative all the way through all of it. So I think it can be very exposing of us as a society. And in the reporting as well, you have to be very critical because a lot of it is still like that. A lot of it's still very male gaze.
Well, I think it's time to sum up the case. We have put our obsession with true crime on trial. Hannah, is our obsession with true crime understandable? Will it continue?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've learned so much about how it's all already happened. Everything we're discussing now with like the rise of social media and vigilante reporting. We're just doing it all over again, slightly differently.
And Roz, what do you think?
I think, yes, our obsession with true crime will continue so long as crime continues in society and it continues to be a point of anxiety for us. But I think that our obsession with true crime will take new forms. So we have the podcast today, the True Crime Podcast, reigns supreme, but it won't tomorrow. And I think that 100, 200 years from now, historians will be looking back on the podcast with fresh eyes and thinking about, what is it doing? You know, what is it trying to show? And they will be studying Red-Handed, and they'll be studying lady killers and lady swindlers. And I would love to be here to read what they end up concluding about us.
We're all going to get a taste of our own medicine.
We certainly will.
But we'll be dead, so we won't care. From the hanging of domestic violence victim Martha Brown to the spectacle of Mary Pearcey and the scandal of Elvira Barney, media, morality, and misogyny have shaped the stories we remember. Whether it's the pamphlets of the 1800s or the TikToks of today, our hunger for grisly details remains the same. But true crime is never just about the crime itself. Studying it also reveals who tells the story, how they tell it, and what it reveals about us all, what we fear, what we admire, and what we choose to forget. For me, that explains why it's probably okay to be guilty of murder mania. Thank you so much to guest detective Hannah Maguire, and as always to our in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone. And thank you for listening to this episode of Lady Killers from BBC Radio 4. And that is the last episode of the season. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Riha Musa, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Moya Angela, Jonathan Keeble, and Ruth Sillers. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor for BBC Radio 4 is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4. You can listen to all the episodes if you search for Lady Killers on BBC Sounds. And you can also enjoy our previous 3 seasons of Lady Killers and 2 seasons of Lady Swindlers. See you next time.
I'm Noel Titheridge, and for BBC Radio 4, from Shadow World, this is Impulsive. What happens when someone's personality changes completely?
It was completely out of character. Never done it before, never done it since.
And it's because of a prescription drug.
I asked myself, why would you do such a thing? What were you thinking?
I've been uncovering the shocking side effects linked to medications called dopamine agonists. For BBC Radio 4, from Shadow World, this is Impulsive. Subscribe to Shadow World Impulsive now on BBC Sounds.